Thanks for downloading this podcast from The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and if you're ready, we'll begin. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. We've got so much territory to cover this hour. Thanks for being with us. Two more pairs of TV characters go head-to-head in our competition to go with the NCAA tournament, the tournament which is reeling from that Northwestern University story about a student union. No, that's not the place on campus to go buy bad hamburgers and such.
We're going streaky! Yes! Sorry.
No, not the old school student union. This week, a student union could end up being a real labor union for big-time college athletes, employees all of a sudden, not just students anymore. We'll talk about that, as well as the real labor union that transformed agriculture in America in the 1960s, the UFW. We'll take a very sobering look at the expanding tragedy in Washington State following the mudslide on unstable ground this week. And Todd Zwillick will explain why, along with the debt limit and government shutdown madness, we have to add the Dr. Fix cliffhanger to the self-immolating dramas on Capitol Hill. But first, two oil giants are sitting down in Riyadh today. One of them, of course, Saudi Arabia, but the other leader of an oil giant is the emir of Washington, D.C., Barack Obama, president of the United States, which is importing less oil from Saudi Arabia today than at any time over the past two decades. And that's just one interesting fact that makes this U.S.-Saudi encounter particularly interesting. Joining us is Robert Worth, contributor to the New York Times Magazine, former Beirut bureau chief for the New York Times. Robert, welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
What is changing in this relationship? I know you're writing a book about the consequences of the Arab Spring. It seems that on the face of it, the changing energy situation that I alluded to and the Arab Spring have really put Saudi Arabia on the defensive right now.
That's true. And I think primarily what President Obama wants to do is reassure the Saudis that the fundamentals of the relationship have not changed. The Saudis have been anxious for a long time because they, as they see it, the Iraq War basically handed Iraq to Iran and changed the balance of power for them. And what's happened over the past couple of years has only made it worse. As you mentioned, you know, the U.S. has become somewhat more independent energy-wise. But for the Saudis, the big threat is Iran. It's always been this great rival for them, Iran being the great Shia power and the Saudis being the Sunni power. And they see Syria as a battlefield in which Iran is really threatening them.
And all of a sudden, there's a new Cold War dynamic with the U.S. and Russia facing off. The Saudis hated the Cold War because it meant that they were just a sideshow. They're back to being something of a sideshow, and I'm wondering how that plays out here.
Well, insofar as the conflict in Ukraine and the Crimea makes Russia less likely to cooperate with any efforts over Iran, it's difficult to see how that plays out, but certainly it could be bad for the Saudis. They're very, very anxious about the outcome of the Syrian war. It's threatening for them in a much more direct way than it is to anybody else. I mean, Al-Qaeda operating there presents to them, you know, a threat just as the jihadis who came back from Afghanistan in the 80s ultimately became Al-Qaeda fighters who fought an insurgency in Saudi Arabia. That was a terrible, terrible crisis for them. And on the other hand, they're determined to defeat Bashar al-Assad, and they fear that the Americans are just not going to – they've seen the Americans are not going to intervene, and they're very angry about it.
Let's talk about some common ground here. Is there any common ground as far as the oil markets are concerned right now between Saudi Arabia and the United States? And what about cooperation in Yemen against al-Qaeda? That was traditionally a very, very warm sort of common ground zone for the U.S. and Saudi Arabia.
On counterterrorism, for the most part, they're still on the same page. And in terms of oil, you know, the fundamentals of the relationship have always been that the Saudis provide consistent free flowing supply of oil, and the Americans provide a security guarantee for the region. And Yemen has become increasingly important there. It's right next to Saudi Arabia. They have, in the past, the Yemenis have always feared that the Saudis were happy with chaos in Yemen. But now that's become much more of a direct threat because you have an Al-Qaeda affiliate in Yemen that is the most active of all the affiliates outside of Afghanistan and Pakistan. And that consists mostly of Saudi, or to a large extent, of Saudi nationals who are determined to strike at Saudi Arabia. So there is a lot of cooperation between the Americans and the Saudis on that.
So looking west in Egypt, General al-Sisi, not as a general, is going to run for president in Egypt. Does that make the Saudis happy? And do you think Egypt comes up in these discussions? Where does it sort of sit in the food chain of issues between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia?
Absolutely. That's another big issue for the Saudis. The Saudis recently declared the Muslim Brotherhood a terrorist group like Al-Qaeda. And for the Saudis, another source of anger is they feel that the Americans have stood against them on this issue. The Americans supported Morsi insofar as he, Mohamed Morsi, was the elected president of Egypt. And they were upset when there was a coup last June when General Sisi and the military overthrew Morsi. Morsi, of course, quickly became the favorite candidate to be the next leader of Egypt. This was a violation of the democratic process. The Americans, of course, say that they're not favoring the Muslim Brotherhood any more than any other group, but they can't abide this kind of violation of basic democracy. And to the Saudis, the Muslim Brotherhood is a really serious threat. They were delighted with the overthrow of Morsi, and they're angry that the Americans aren't more supportive about that.
What about the leverage that Saudi Arabia has traditionally had over the United States? Is that at a sort of a weak point, a nadir right now? And what would you make of the leadership in Saudi Arabia right now going forward in terms of Saudi's domestic problems, sort of holding it all together there in Saudi Arabia?
Well, the Saudis have always done checkbook diplomacy. Money was the big force for them, and they've certainly used that lately. The day after the overthrow of Mohamed Morsi, they pledged billions of dollars, and their Gulf allies, Kuwait and the United Arab Emirates, also pledged. I think the total is now something like $15 billion in loans and aid. A very, very clear sign that they were happy with the overthrow and very, very happy to keep, you know, pushing it back against the Muslim Brotherhood, which, you know, some Saudis characterize as kind of a regional war.
And if we're talking about the leadership in Saudi Arabia before we go, I would suspect that given the issues that you've outlined here, there may be some incentive for the Saudi leadership to really think beyond Barack Obama to who occupies the White House next in 2016.
Yes, absolutely. They're not comfortable with Obama. They feel that he doesn't really I think it's two things. It's partly sort of a more a basic issue that they feel he doesn't side with them on issues relating to Iran, the Muslim Brotherhood. They feel that if there's a deal cut with the Iranians on the nuclear issue, that they will somehow pay the price for that by allowing the U.S. will allow Iran to be more active in places like Lebanon and Syria. And it's also partly personal. They feel that Obama has not paid them the kind of respect just in terms of public gestures that they would like. And I think that's a big part of this trip. Obama wants to reassure them, to sort of to show them that he respects them, to have a face-to-face greeting. And so that should help. Hmm. But absolutely, they would love to see somebody different.
All right. Robert Wirth, contributor to the New York Times Magazine, former Beirut bureau chief for the New York Times on the ingredients for an awkward meeting, a testy meeting, full of anxiety there in Saudi Arabia between Barack Obama and the leadership of Saudi Arabia. Robert, thanks so much.
It's a pleasure.
So the Northwestern University movement to create a union for college athletes has stirred the pot in big-time college sports. We'll talk about that later this hour. Meanwhile, we have stirred up another hornet's nest. This was sort of our intention with our TV bracket competition online. As we narrow the list of TV greats to 8 quarterfinalists, your anger at who was left out is reaching a peak. Eileen from Tigard, Oregon, writes on our website, OMG, as a former TV Guide editor and boomer, I am devastated at the narrow field of candidates. Bill writes, no Hawkeye, no Dr. Huxtable. You've missed some really big ones. Folks, I'm totally with you on this one. As the only boomer on this show and the only person who could pick Jackie Gleason out of a lineup, having to take shows like Game of Thrones and Breaking Bad seriously in an all-time greats competition, painful for me. But I can get some possible revenge later this hour. In a moment, you'll have to go to thetakeaway.org or call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE to vent. You had the pop culture demo, though, clashing with the public broadcasting demo in yesterday's voting. Elaine Bennis from Seinfeld versus the Dowager Countess from Downton Abbey, our closest vote yet, and the Countess won by 3 votes out of more than 1,400 casts. The Countess moves on.
I'm tougher than I look.
Downton fans happy, no doubt. Our very Lord Grantham executive producer certainly is. But I'm afraid this next competition may reignite some more passions about our TV theater of the obscure. But here we go. The games must go on. Entering the arena today, 2 takeaway staffers with 2 cult fave seeds, Omar Little from The Wire and Agent Dale Cooper from Twin Peaks.
What exactly do you do for a living, Mr. Little?
I rob drug dealers.
Omar Little is not just the best character on The Wire.
He's the best character in TV history.
Even if I miss, I can't miss.
Despite his name, Omar is far from little.
Man, money ain't got no owners. Only spenders.
His presence is larger than life. He is the big bad wolf. And when Omar's a-coming, you run.
You don't need to open his door, man, for a huff and puff.
But the brilliance of Omar is that he's a walking contradiction. He's actually one of the most benevolent and loved characters on that show.
Ew.
He's the guy robbing the drug dealers. And in that way, he's the Robin Hood of Baltimore.
Omar definitely was a man of morals. He had his code.
That's actor Michael K. Williams, who says this is his favorite scene on The Wire.
You are a parasite who leeches off
just like you,
the culture
man.
Of drugs. Excuse me? What?
I got the shotgun. You got the briefcase. It's on the game, though, right?
Vote for Omar, one of the most complex, brilliantly created characters ever.
Diane, 11:30 a.m., February 24th, entering the town of Twin Peaks.
The combed back black hair, the tape recorder diary, the love of coffee and cherry pie. There's no other man like him.
Federal Bureau of Investigation, Special Agent Dale Cooper.
David Lynch's oddball murder mystery, Twin Peaks, gave America the gift of Dale Cooper, the smart, sensitive, corny field agent whose dedication to the law, justice, and decency make him the perfect FBI agent. But he is unusual.
Following a dream I had 3 years ago, I have become deeply moved by the plight of the Tibetan people and filled with a desire to help them.
He's neither corrupt nor cynical. His methods blend deductive reasoning and supernatural intuition. He loves nature and taking time for the good things in life.
Every day, give yourself a present. Don't plan it, just let it happen.
The ultimate Eagle Scout and a strong, comforting protector, vote for Agent Dale Cooper as TV's greatest character at thetakeaway.org.
This is a damn fine cup of coffee.
That's Takeaway senior producer Irva Gunja and Takeaway engineer Vince Fairchild defending Omar Little from The Wire and Agent Dale Cooper from Twin Peaks. Later this hour, Sybil Fawlty from Fawlty Towers and Lucy from I Love Lucy go head-to-head. But it's up to you to vote. Go to our website at thetakeaway.org to cast your vote. This is The Takeaway.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
So let's say you're on the operating table heading into surgery, and as you slip into the anesthesia, your doctor whispers that he's just received a notification of a big pay cut from his employer. You'd think, hey, I may never wake up. Who would cut the pay of a doctor in the middle of an operation? Congress, of course. This happens every couple of years, too. Doctor pay in the Medicare program expires, and lawmakers have to decide what to do.
We didn't want to vote for it. We didn't want to vote against it because bad
things happen. So you didn't vote at all?
Well, in essence, that's what happened.
We're back to what's called the Medicare patch, a bramble patch of thorny political issues. And right in the middle of it, our Brer Rabbit of Washington, Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Welcome, Todd.
Hi, John.
So there you are talking to Representative John Fleming of Louisiana about a vote over this Medicare patch. Please explain how we got here and what happened yesterday.
Well, how we got here, we have to go back to 1997, John. It's called the Doc Fix, also called the SGR, the Sustainable Growth Rate. Lots of names for it. But what it is a case study in the worst kind of shell game accounting that Washington can offer. Let's go back, as I said, to 1997. A law called the Balanced Budget Act. Congress wanted to make it seem like they were balancing budgets, like they were spending responsibly. It was really tough to come up with the money without a tax increase, as you can imagine. So one of the things that they did is they said, hey, you know what's really expensive? Healthcare costs. And you know what a big part of that is? Medicare and what we pay doctors and hospitals. It costs so much money. Man, how are we going to make it seem like we're balancing a budget? I know what we'll do. We'll go to the out years. We'll go way in the future. How about 2011, 2012, 2014? You know, when our kids are all grown up and out of college, and we'll pretend like we're
members
of Congress. Yeah. And we'll pretend like we're going to cut doctors' pay by 20%, 30%, 40%. We'll just do that accounting. We'll take that money and front load it, and we'll put it in the budget now to plug all of our budget holes and make it seem like we have a balanced budget. What are we going to do when we get to those out years and the doctors are going to get cut? We'll deal with that later. It's as simple as that, a big accounting gimmick, mm-hmm. and that's how we got here.
And the emotion here, and that gets us to the debate and the vote yesterday, is all about this issue of nobody wants to, cut the pay so dramatically of doctors when people's health hangs in the balance.
And so what has happened every year since this budgeting gimmick is they do what's called the doc fix on Capitol Hill. That's every 18 months or 2 years or so when the existing law expires, Congress comes around and tries to find the money to pour down the hole that they've created. Now, they finally want to put an end to this. They want to come up with a permanent fix to this lousy system. And Republicans and Democrats both want to do it, but they can't agree on how to pay for it. It costs about $180 billion, and it won't surprise you, John, to hear that there's no agreement on how to come up with $180 billion in this partisan environment. So another doc fix. Let's fix it for a year. But here's the problem. What happened yesterday? There's no consensus at all. Nobody is for a one-year fix. They don't have the votes. It was clear on the House floor yesterday. Democrats opposed a one-year fix. Republicans opposed a one-year fix. But nobody wanted to see the terrible scenario of the patient on the table and doctors get cut 24%. So you heard Congressman Fleming, who's a doctor himself, say to me there that they didn't want to vote for it. They didn't want to vote against it. And let me tell you what happened, John. We were all standing outside of an office on Capitol Hill waiting to see what the agreement was going to be. Could they get the votes to pass this one-year doc fix, about $25 billion that nobody wanted? And Eric Cantor, the majority leader, sprinted out of that room, past the reporters, onto the House floor where we can't follow him, ran up to Steady Hoyer, the House Democratic whip, had a quick conversation, and bang, bang, voice vote, that bill was passed without a vote, no roll call vote. And when members came to the floor, they were surprised to learn it had passed right from under them. Nobody had to vote for it. Nobody had to vote against it.
So how did that go down with the folks that you talked with yesterday?
Well, John, listen to Jerry Connolly. He's a fourth-term member of Congress. He's from Virginia, who came off the floor red-faced and sheepish about what had just happened.
Can people interpret what just happened as anything but kind of sneaky?
To quote the House of Cards, you might say that. You might very well say that, but I cannot comment.
Every other word out of these lawmakers lately is House of Cards. It's so interesting. Yeah. Where does this go now?
Well, John, I just want to say, if there's one thing that unites your divided Congress in these troubled times, it's the desire and the ability to avoid responsibility, which is exactly what they did yesterday. Nobody wanted to vote for this one-year fix because they didn't want to pour money down the hole, and they thought it would take energy away from the effort to reform things permanently. Nobody wanted to vote against it because they didn't want to see the doctors get cut. So you saw what happened yesterday. They didn't vote at all, and they all kind of stood around with their hands in their pockets without having to go on record, a real profile in courage. Well, now it goes to the Senate, and there are a lot of senators who are opposed to what went on the House floor yesterday. This is going to come up for a vote on Monday. And the question over in the Senate is going to be, are they going to go along with this? Because if they don't, those doctor fees expire on Monday, and then the American Medical Association and some of the heaviest lobbying hitters in Washington come after you. Now, Tom Coburn is a doctor also. He's from Oklahoma. He's opposed to this whole deal. Listen to Coburn.
It's a farce in terms of how it's paid for.
Why?
Because it's all funny money. It's not real stuff. It's moving dates. I've got a whole list. You can talk to my staff on the list of how it's paid for. None of it's 30% of it's real.
So Senator Tom Coburn, Republican from Oklahoma, really disgusted there. Is this Monday vote a cliffhanger?
It really, really is, because according to Senate rules, there are some senators, and Coburn's not the only one. Ron Wyden, who's chairman of the Finance Committee, this is his area. He's against this whole thing. He says, everybody slow down. I can still get us a big deal on the permanent fix. But, John, a real profile in courage, and you could hear how upset Coburn is. In a way, it was fitting. This SGR, this balanced budget story from 1997, was a shell game to begin with, and they used a shell game yesterday on the House floor to avoid responsibility for having to fix it.
All right, what is the media going to do without Mike Rogers on the Hill, the Republican outspoken congressman who decided to leave the House?
And he's chairman of the Intelligence Committee. What's the media going to do without him? The media gets more Mike Rogers, because Mike Rogers is giving up his chairmanship on that committee, John, to get his own radio show. So watch out. little bit of competition for
for all of us there. Todd Zwillick, all the happenings on Capitol Hill. Have a great weekend, Todd.
You bet. You too, John.
Todd Zwillick, our Br'er Rabbit on Capitol Hill, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Thanks so much. For many Americans who have never heard of him, the movie Cesar Chavez will be the first time the story is told of Cesar Chavez, the visionary activist who organized migrant farm workers in California in the 1960s, creating the United Farm Workers Union. Chavez had more than a few collaborators by his side, and in the toughest days of the confrontations with big agriculture, he was joined by Dolores Huerta. That story is also told in the film.
We have no laws to protect us here. With the boycott, there are no laws to stop us. This is the moment, Caesar. This is what we came here to do.
That's Rosario Dawson as Dolores Huerta, the co-founder of the movement that created the United Farm Workers. The real Dolores Huerta joins us now. Dolores, welcome.
Hello, how are you doing?
Great. So many people will hear the story of what you and Cesar Chavez did back in the 60s for the first time in this film. What do you think they're going to take away from it?
What we hope they take away is that the farm workers were able to overcome many, many obstacles, including the opposition like agribusiness, the large growers, the judges, the police, the sheriffs, Governor of California, then Ronald Reagan, the President of the United States, Richard Nixon. And these were all forces that were against the farm workers, denying them their basic rights, human rights like drinking water in the field and toilets in the fields, et cetera. And they were able to overcome these obstacles by calling on the American public to help them by not eating grapes, by boycotting stores that carried grapes. And they were able to get some of these basic benefits, including the right to organize.
How did you see that grapes by themselves would have this power in a boycott?
Well, it was an economic power that we had by people power, about farm workers that went to the cities asking people to support them. And by doing this, they were able to really have some economic sanctions against the employers that then brought them to the bargaining table.
Do the movie folks get this story right? Is it sort of sugared up for movie audiences?
Well, I believe so. I mean, you can't put many years into an hour and a half, but I think that the major points of the story are correct. I think the one thing that is left out is that there was a lot of civic engagement on the part of the farm workers and the movement, you know, getting people to register vote. We did a lot of work on Robert Kennedy's campaign when he was running to make sure that he got elected, although we lost him, as everybody knows, on that election night. The other thing is that there were a lot of death threats on Cesar's life, and, of course, that doesn't show up in the movie either. But it's an important story, especially when you think of the personal sacrifices that Cesar and his family had to make.
And that's really the important point here, is that, you know, the camera may not like civic engagement. It doesn't make for great storytelling, but the story really is convincing people, one consumer at a time, one political leader at a time, to join a movement. And that's really the story that you and Cesar Chavez brought to reality.
Yeah, and I believe that the main point also of the story is that people have power. Like the farm workers themselves, you may be poor, you may not have any money, you may not even be a U.S. citizen, but the thing is that if we all come together and we take direct nonviolent action, this is the way that we make changes. And we want to invite everybody to come to see it this weekend when it comes out. Then hopefully we'll get more of our stories out there on the big screen, because there's more people understand what many people have gone through, people of color in this country, then I think it makes people a lot more compassionate and more inclusive to really create a real democracy.
24/7, the activist and organizer Dolores Huerta, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Dolores Huerta, labor leader and civil rights activist who co-founded the National Farm Workers Association, which later became the United Farm Workers.
Worst episode ever.
I see a lot of films. I love all of them.
Your job is to rate movies on a scale from good to excellent.
Hated it.
Continuing with Movie Friday, Kristen Meinzer, culture producer for The Takeaway and co-host of the Movie Date podcast, is with us, along with Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday and co-host of the podcast. Welcome, guys.
Happy Friday, John.
So let's go right to the UFW movie. Dolores Huerta gave it a good review. It's a movie about Cesar Chavez, directed by Diego Luna, starring Michael Pena. America Ferrera plays Helen Chavez, and Rosario Dawson plays Dolores Huerta, who is now in her 80s, very chipper for her 80s. How does this film play out, Kristen?
You know, the cast is fantastic, and I love this story. I think it's a really important story to tell. Unfortunately, I feel the story should have been set up a little bit better. I think we should have seen more of the struggles. This is a great David and Goliath story that really should have been really playing credit to that fact that it's David and Goliath.
Just can't get your head out of the Bible, can you? Rafer, what did you think?
You know, I have to agree with Kristen. I think it's nice to see a movie like this that will show, though, that will show people what exactly it is that Cesar Chavez did and the achievements that he made for labor workers. That was a good thing to see.
But John Malkovich does get to play a bad guy.
So who the hell is this Cesar Chavez?
Nobody knows. Somebody said he was from Arizona. Word is he used to hang around Alinsky and the other commies from the CSO. He's been up and down the valley stirring up trouble.
Yeah, I heard he's Mexican. Seems a safe bet.
So much has changed. Now, Barack Obama, who used to hang around Alinsky and the other commies from the CSO, is in the White House. Does Malkovich work here, Rafer?
You know, he's a producer of the film, so he gets a fair amount of screen time here. He's actually quite funny as one of the growers. I like when he speaks this kind of schoolboy Spanish to his workers. He's a good villain. You know, again, I think the film sees things in pretty clear black and white terms. I would have liked to have seen a little more nuance from both the villains and from Chavez, frankly.
So from David and Goliath, our biblical scholar here, Kristen Meinzer, you want to take the first crack at Noah?
You know, I think most of us have heard of this guy with the ark, and this movie uses that as a jumping off point. We'll say that it's not a literal translation of the Bible.
This all belongs to me. This land, this forest, that stronghold of yours. Did you really think you could protect yourself from me in that?
It's not protection from you.
Then what is it?
An ark. To hold the innocent when the Creator sends his deluge to wipe out the wicked from this world.
Well, we know Russell Crowe could fight in Gladiator, and he can steer a boat in Master and Commander. How does he do, piloting this potential biblical franchise, Rafer?
I doubt it's going to be a franchise. I don't see a second chapter. But it's interesting. It's been a lot of controversy about this film. A lot of controversy from the faith-based community over Darren Aronofsky, the director, taking too many liberties with the film and posing it as an environmentalist fable, which I think it quite clearly is. I think it works as Hollywood entertainment. I think it's a great spectacle. It's a lot of fun. It's a little silly, but I think it's also in some ways really serious about what it's trying to do and in giving us a real new interpretation of gospel.
You didn't like Divergent. It did 56 mil at the box office last weekend. What do you think this one's going to do, Noah?
I think this one's probably going to do pretty well. There are a lot of special effects. Some of the special effects are great. There are also rock monsters, bazookas, magical wizard powers, a lot of things that you might not remember from the Bible. So
rock
I think
monsters.
Some audiences might really like that.
That was in Deuteronomy. Nobody reads Deuteronomy. Okay, Rafer, what's on the podcast this week?
This week we're going to speak to a Christian blogger who was one of the first guys to fan the flames of controversy over Noah. He's seen the film, and we're going to see what he thinks about it.
Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday and co-host of the Movie Date podcast, which you can find at thetakeaway.org. Also, Kristen Meinzer, culture producer for The Takeaway and co-host. Have a great weekend, guys.
Thanks so much, John.
We'll be right back. There's a growing realization that the Oso mudslide in western Washington state will end up being one of the worst disasters in the history of the Pacific Northwest in terms of loss of life. The search for the missing and the painstaking recovery from the huge debris field is slow and deeply emotional.
It gets really quiet for a few minutes. You can almost hear a pin drop out there. You see seasoned veterans in this business. They start to tear up. Their eyes get glossy.
That's Travis Hotz, Snohomish County Fire Chief, who, along with a few others, has become the face of this disaster. And in front of the media once again today, an emotional Chief Hotz faced some heated questions about why he can't be more forthcoming about enumerating the exact number of dead.
There's a process that we have in place, and I don't want to get into too many details of that because, you know, this is a sensitive situation for people who have lost their loved ones. It's not as simple as just saying that, yep, this is the number of people that we have that we've recovered. There's processes that we have that we're going through to get people to the medical examiner's office. The medical examiner's office is doing a great job, and they've got to do their work, and then they'll report their numbers when they're done. Next question.
I'll answer your question. I'm sorry, Michelle. The medical examiner's office has not been responding. They're not answering the phone. And there have been reports that there were four individuals who were identified by the medical examiner's office: Bill Welsh, Kaylee Spillers, Stephen Neal, Christina Jeffords. Can we at least identify those individuals?
I'll find out from the medical examiner's office, and we'll get back to you at tonight's briefing.
That's one exchange from a news conference today on the Oso mudslide. Joining us now is Ed Ronco. Ed Ronco is Morning Edition reporter and producer for KPLU Public Radio in Seattle, Washington. Ed, welcome back.
Hi, John.
How would you characterize this level of tension that seems to be rising, you know, on all sides for very different reasons? We just heard an example of it there.
Well, we're a week into the search, and there's a disconnect between the official process of numbers they can release and what we're hearing from people on the ground, including people, you know, wearing uniforms or representing government agencies who say, oh, they found more bodies, so people do the math. But then at the same time, in the official press releases and press conferences, they're coming out with numbers that are below that math. So it's frustrating, partly because the reporters on scene are eager to get accurate information out, and partly because the community is waiting to hear exactly the magnitude of what's happened out there.
And the numbers we have right now, and again, all this stuff is so fluid. We've got dozens missing, perhaps as high as 80. Is that where things stand right now? And you're going to get more briefings later today and through the weekend.
That's right. And they've winnowed that number down from a higher total that they had when they were just looking at kind of vague reports. Hopefully later in the day, there will be more information on exactly who is missing. There was also confusion or I guess a wish to get the names of the missing out there. The county saying that there's legal uncertainty around that, and they're looking into whether they're actually allowed to release those names. Obviously, many people feel that if they did, that would help find out if they are in fact missing people.
Well, another indication of just how unprecedented this disaster is, even though the idea of mudslides isn't unprecedented in that part of the country, in western Washington. You know, Ed, this really reminds me of back in 1980 after the Mount St. Helens disaster, where 57 people died. Geologically, this is a much smaller event, and there was a huge amount of warning for that because the mountain began to rumble before it exploded. But the scenes of devastation and the sort of mudslides and the blocked roads take me right back to covering that story back in 1980.
You're not alone in describing it that way. Officials and reporters at the scene have said exactly that, especially those. And there are a lot of reporters in our market still working today who covered that actively and remember it very clearly and are saying this is much the same thing. We had a story on our air this morning from reporter Tom Bonsi, who interviewed an official out there, who said, you know, they're similar. The scale, as you said, John, is a lot different, but they are very similar events in that this is a massive movement of Earth that is geologically uncertain. And in fact, they're having geologists come in today to look and make sure that it's not going to move anymore. They said they believe that everybody out there right now is safe, of course, but that they're definitely keeping an eye on exactly that.
And the fact that you have to rely on geologists is an indication of the scale of the forces involved here. I understand they're constrained to use heavy equipment because there's still concern for remains and possible recovery, even survivors at this point. Is that the case?
They're being very, very delicate with heavy equipment. They're shutting it down often when victims or victims' families come in when they remove a body. It can be eerily silent out there, according to the reports we've heard. We do know that there are remains. Well, obviously there are remains still to be withdrawn from the rubble. But what we know is that they're holding out hope that there's somebody out there, that they're going to get some good news, that there's some survival. Those hopes have diminished as we've gotten into now day 7 of this, but they aren't willing yet to switch from calling it a rescue to a recovery fully. They are starting to use that word recovery, but it is still very much a hopeful operation out there.
No, and I remember from both Mount St. Helens and other disasters that I've covered in the past, and I'm sure you have, that transition from rescue to recovery is such an emotional moment for the responders, as well as the media, and certainly the people for whom it signals that hope is lost. What's the weather like? Last time we spoke to you, they were still saying there's unstable ground out there.
It's a big problem today, and that is their chief concern as they enter today's work. An inch of rain is in the forecast today. That would make it the wettest day since the landslide happened on Saturday. What it means, of course, is that some of the mud that had become solid and slightly easier to work with is going to turn slippery again and make work much, much harder out there.
I want to play one more selection from the briefing that was given by Travis Hotz, the Snohomish County Fire Chief, which is an indication of just how the voices in this community are trying to raise the profile of this disaster with so much coverage of the plane out in Asia and other things going on. Listen.
Please, if it's something that you can do, help these folks up here. Some of these people have lost their homes, they've lost their cars, they've lost their entire families, and you know, there's funerals that'll be need to be paid for. They need to rebuild, and I'm pleading with the community to please dig deep and continue to give them the support that we've been giving them.
It's Chief Hotz talking there, Snohomish County Fire Chief. Are those voices getting through? Are people feeling isolated out there before we go?
I think they are, and I think that I've seen social media, even from like a local news anchor, saying, where are the network news anchors? Why isn't this getting more attention? They definitely are hopeful that people will continue to remember them, send cash rather than donations, and just not forget as we get into more and more days of searching out there exactly what's happened.
Well, really amazing work from your team there at KPLU. Ed Ronco is Morning Edition reporter and producer for KPLU Public Radio in Seattle, covering the Oso mudslide in western Washington. Thanks, Ed.
Thank you, John.
In a moment, we will finish out the week of our TV greats matchups to go with the NCAA tournament. But we need to note that the Elite Eight competition for men's basketball, the eight will be set in the next few days. Those eight have been upstaged by talk this week of a Super Elite 60 in the wake of a decision by the National Labor Relations Board to allow Northwestern University's football team to unionize. If the big school teams, and there are believed to be about 60, have to treat their elite athletes as employees in the future, part of an $11 billion sports entertainment enterprise, what does that do to everything else, everywhere else, and everyone else in college sports? We're going to spend a few minutes now with Gabe Feldman, law professor and director of Tulane University's sports law program. Gabe, welcome.
Thanks. How are you?
Great. This has opened up such a can of worms. I mean, everything from Title IX to the difference between big schools and small schools to what is a scholarship. You want to take one?
Sure. I mean, let's start at the very beginning and say all these questions that have been raised. But well, what is going to happen to college football and college basketball if Northwestern football players and other football players can unionize? It's going to destroy college sports. We heard many of those very same things when Major League Baseball players talked about unionizing. And Major League Baseball and the other professional sports are doing just fine right now. It will cause a radical shift in the way the schools and the athletes and the conferences do business, but I don't know that necessarily makes a radical change in the end product. It could, but we're a long way from knowing how this is all going to shake out, because remember, all we have is a preliminary ruling from a regional director of the NLRB in Chicago that's going to get appealed to the full board and then all the way up to the federal court and maybe all the way to the Supreme Court. and it only applies to private schools.
Although
the NRA does not apply. Yep, go ahead.
Since you opened the door on the baseball analogy, are we going to see sometime in the future a Miguel Cabrera freshman going to college with a $260 million contract all of a sudden? Because that's what free agency gave us in baseball.
Well, I think it gave us a free market. And I think if we end up with a free market in college sports, we may have the 1% or the 0.5% of the stars on college football teams maybe making a lot of money. And I don't think that the remainder of the football players, the basketball players, are going to be breaking the bank. Some may actually get less than they do now if it's a free market. I don't know what the answer is going to be to dictate that, but that's just one possible result. Just because you have a union and collective bargaining doesn't mean that you're going to get true free agency. That's something that took a while for the baseball players to get and all professional athletes to get, and it may not be what the college athletes get, because all employers are going to have to decide in any unionized industry how much you can afford to pay your employees. And so when you talk about the impacts of Title IX, the limitations of small schools versus big schools, that's going to be a factor, and not all college athletes are going to get rich just because they might be able to form unions at their schools.
But the NCAA already treats recruited athletes kind of like a free market system. I'm just wondering if the net effect of treating athletes as employees means that instead of college admissions, it becomes a kind of a draft for those top 60 schools.
Well, I think that's probably where we are already in a sense. And it's just that the benefits that the student athletes are getting are capped. And so these schools are trying to find different ways to attract them. And there's all this money floating around. But the money right now is, as we know, flowing to the coaches and flowing to athletic departments and flowing to facilities. It's just not flowing to student athletes. So this would just say, we're going to continue competing for these student athletes the same way, but this time they're getting more of a benefit out of it.
Last minute, Gabe. Will the money flow to women's sports under Title IX in a different way, the way things are going here?
It would have to, unless there's a change to Title IX. And I think people are saying, well, this might destroy women's sports and non-revenue sports. This actually might help them, because you have to factor that into how much you're going to pay these football players. Because if you're going to pay them $1 million, then you got to find $1 million to go to, or roughly, to go to your female athletes. And if you don't have $1 million for both, then you pay $500,000 to the men, $500,000 to the women. So I think this could actually benefit women in the long run.
Interesting. A lot of implications, a lot of question marks. Gabe Feldman is law professor and director of Tulane University's sports law program. Have a great weekend, Gabe.
Thanks, you too.
So now to our TV bracket competition at the end of the hour. We begin by noting your outrage over who didn't make it into our tournament. And unlike the NCAA, which is fairly opaque and unresponsive to criticism, we have taken your angst to heart. Comments like James from New York City: any contest without Frank Pembleton from Homicide is not worth playing.
Of course I'm discombobulated. I work in a safe deposit box, for God's sake.
Whiskey shouts, how can this even be a valid bracket without the inclusion of Hawkeye Pierce from MASH? Alan Alda's character is one of the best male acting performances in television history.
You don't trust me.
Not since the first time I found you hiding in my sleeping bag.
Got me there. And so we're opening up the competition. Next Friday, when we have the top two finalists from our bracket selected, we will add a wild card.
Wild card!
A third contestant based on your comments at thetakeaway.org. But right now, another elimination round. Boomer's revenge is at hand. As entering the arena, I defend Lucy from I Love Lucy versus my colleague Liz Ross defending Sybil Fawlty from Fawlty Towers. No brainer, right? Again, there's that strong public broadcasting vote out there, so I'm a little worried in this round.
My pick for the greatest TV character of all time? It has to be Sybil Fawlty, played by Prunella Scales in the 1970s British sitcom Fawlty Towers.
I'm just cursed with a sensitive nature, I'm afraid.
Who else could express such empathy with so few words?
Oh, I know. Exactly. I know you have. I know.
Only Sybil could keep her larger-than-life husband, Basil Fawlty, played by John Cleese, firmly under control.
Shall I deal with this, Basil?
I'm dealing with it, dear.
No, dear, that's all right. Now you wanted two singles.
I said I'd deal with it.
Do you mind sharing your bathroom?
Look, I was here first.
Well, it's my turn now, then.
I fought the Korean War, you know. I killed four men.
He was in the catering corps. He used to poison them.
Vote for Sybil Fawlty as the best TV character of all time.
First of all, Lucy rules, period. Who didn't love Lucy, a female comedian who dominated the screen? Even in black and white, her fiery red hair could get a laugh.
Yeah, you ought to hear me. You never heard me blow. I'm the wildest man. Oh, wasn't that the craziest day you ever heard?
All who came after, and I mean all, owe a debt to Lucy. Mary Tyler Moore, The Flying Nun, Elaine from Seinfeld, the gang from Cheers and Friends, the likes of Jennifer Aniston, Courtney Cox, Roseanne, Fran Drescher, all understand every time they get a laugh, it goes back to Lucy.
So why don't you join the thousands of happy, peppy people and get a great big bottle of Mitamita Midgemin.
Vitamina Vegemin forever, folks. Lucy played basically the same character through five different hit shows, eventually acquiring the showbiz influence of an Oprah. Okay, maybe that's cheating, but folks, I'm sorry. This is a layup. Hey, Lucy, you rule.
Listen, Ethel, I think this... I think we're fighting a losing game.
Lucy from I Love Lucy up against Takeaway associate producer Elizabeth Ross defending Sybil Fawlty. So go vote. Check the standings, pick the wild card at thetakeaway.org, or just vent at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Best of luck to Tony Soprano, Archie Bunker, Liz Lemon, Data from Star Trek, and Mary Richards. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.